Welcome to the RDU Onstage Radio Hour. This is Agatha Christie. It is 100 years ago that I wrote The Mysterious Affair at Styles, and I'm proud to share with you today a reading of a lovely little piece of theatre that was created several years back called Tea with Agatha. Enjoy.
Welcome to the RDU On Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, we're doing something a little bit different. We are presenting our first audio drama of sorts, which will be followed by a virtual talkback on Facebook Live with the creatives behind the production. So sit back, grab your tea and crumpets, and enjoy this audio broadcast of Mia Self's Tea with Agatha, featuring Mia Self as Agatha Christie and Gus Allen as Max.
Agatha, darling, they're here.
What, dear?
Your visitors. Look, right here in the flesh. Your visitors have come to see you.
Oh, really, Max? They might well be here to see you.
Oh, why on earth would they come to see me?
You're a very well-known archaeologist. Perhaps they would like to hear you speak about Nimrud, or the shift to prehistoric excavation, or your work in Iraq with the British School of Archaeology, or your service in World War II in North Africa, or perhaps being knighted.
Agatha, please. You, Dame Agatha Christie, are the most published author in the English-speaking world. Besides, their little program clearly says, Tea with Agatha.
Tea with Agatha? But I haven't nearly enough tea for everyone. This is most distressing. There's so many of them.
Agatha, it's quite all right. They don't look terribly thirsty. I think they'll manage quite nicely if you sit over here and take your tea with them over there.
Oh, I do get flustered when I must speak with strangers. Really, Max, whatever shall I say to them?
Just tell them about you, about the books you've written, the plays, the places you've been. Tell them all about your life, Agatha.
Oh, Max. Do help me. I don't know where to begin, how to start.
Let me pour you a cup of tea.
Oh, thank you.
Begin at the beginning, dear. Perhaps this will help. The beginning. Your beginning, in fact.
Indeed. Well, I was born on the 15th of September in 1890 in Torquay, which is in Devon, which is in the southwest of England. I was born in Ashfield, my mother's beloved home, the home she would not be dissuaded from buying after she married my father in 1878. Her name was Clara Bomer Miller, and my father was Friedrich Alva Miller. He was an American. I was the third child. My elder sister's name was Margaret, and my brother Monty. They were older than I by almost a decade.
Your name, dear?
Oh, yes. They named me Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller.
Agatha is a bit shy, always has been. Her sister spoke of her being impossibly shy of strangers as a child, but with family and close friends, she was voluble. What do you remember of your childhood, dear?
Oh, it was wonderful being a child, especially being a child at Ashfield. I had my attic nursery and books to read and the most wonderful little hoop I used to play with in the gardens. I would pretend to be a conductor on the train, and with my hoop and my Yorkie Tony, we would make the rounds of the garden, calling out station names as we went.
Did you have friends you want to talk about?
Oh, yes, I had the most wonderful imaginary friends as a child. There were several girls who were at a boarding school together. Several of them were orphans.
Did you have friends of the flesh and blood variety?
Oh, Yes, a few. The Huxley girls were particular favourites. They were wild and chaotic. They never got anywhere on time, but they made the most amazing plans. We did The Yeomen of the Guard together.
Righto, Gilbert and Sullivan. And who were you?
Colonel Fairfax.
A breeches role? Was it fun?
Oh, it was ever so much fun. I do hate to talk in front of people, but I love to sing. And the Huxley girls were the worst sort for encouraging one to do something extravagant. Oh, I do so love to sing. I love music altogether. But I was never quite good enough for the concert hall. Now, writing. I've written forever. I used to write the most dreadful little poems and submit them to magazines and the paper. I got enough encouragement to keep on to pass the time.
When did it become more than that?
Later, when I was married. But the seed was planted when my sister threw down the gauntlet. Madge had been writing and submitting stories for years and could tell a marvellous tale of her own. When she was home with us, I pestered her to share Sherlock Holmes' stories. She had seen all of my little poems and couldn't believe it when I told her I should like to write a novel like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. She declared that I couldn't possibly finish a book. I couldn't bear it, her certainty that I was incapable of writing such a thing.
So you took out your pen and began to write.
No. I probably went to the neighbourhood dance, but the idea stuck in my head, and later I would meet that challenge.
Several times over, I should say. Was it terribly difficult living with that?
No. It was much more difficult to lose my father and to fear for the fate of my mother and myself. Father died when I was 11, and mother never recovered. She managed as best she could, which meant long days spent in bed. I would keep her company and help as best I could.
You nursed her yourself?
More listening than nursing. I would stand by the door listening, just to know that she was still breathing. When you've lost someone you loved dearly as a child, it is difficult to believe that everyone you love won't be snatched away.
You travelled then, did you not?
Oh, we did, out of necessity. Ashfield could be rented, and we could stay abroad for very little. So we spent months during the season in France to gain the income from the rental. Mother was pleased that I could practice my French, and I enjoyed travelling. I have always enjoyed new places and people. Was also enjoying the romance of men.
At 11?
Oh, heavens, no, not at 11. 13, perhaps.
You did get started early with all the travel abroad.
No, don't be foolish, Max, darling. I'm not talking about being courted at the age of 13. My word, what an idea. My granny would be rolling in her grave at the very idea.
What do you mean by romance, then?
Oh, the merest idea of romance. That one day I might marry, and who might he be, and who would I become because of him? That is what I mean by romance. I was still terribly shy around people, men in particular, but still it was a thrilling thing for a young girl to ponder.
Who did you imagine marrying?
A sea captain, a pirate even.
I imagine you find me extraordinarily boring if you had your cap set for a pirate.
An archaeologist seems rather exotic to me when compared with bankers and businessmen.
I'd appreciate your determination to keep me a romantic figure, then. We men do like to play the hero in our own stories.
As do women, dear. As do the women. Though perhaps not all.
What is this picture here?
Oh, I do love that image. That was a dance class from my girlhood. I did love to dance. We would learn a series of dances and stage an entertainment for our parents. It was good practice for coming out and for what was to come next. It was a wonderful, ridiculous phase where we danced in the style of Greek ladies, pulled right from the vases of ancient history. But we generally danced the social dances of the day, the waltz and the tango. There was a rather difficult period when we were learning to dance on the stairs.
What was that like?
Oh, tumbles and tangled limbs. It was dreadful, but short-lived.
A tremendous opportunity to get to know someone, rather more than usual.
You mean if they lie atop you at the foot of the stairs?
Just so.
It did prepare me rather well for coming out, all that tumbling and crushing about. I could dance nearly anything on the ballroom floor after that.
How did you come out into society?
Well, there was no money for London, of course, so Mother, being both determined and thrifty, bought tickets to Cairo. Here, this is the site of my introduction into society. The Jezira Palace Hotel. Oh, it was a wonderful place to practice conversing with men. There was a dance there every night, and Cairo was filled to the brim with Britons travelling for just such a reason. We stayed at the hotel for 3 months, and I danced like I have never danced before or since.
What sights did you take in?
Sights? Whatever do you mean?
The Pyramids of Giza, the Valley of the Kings, the mosques.
Darling Max, ever the archaeologist. I was a foolish and short-sighted girl then. When the opportunities presented themselves, I brushed them off for parties. I know, dearest, but the young are only young once. It was a wild time, and Mother was more trusting in Cairo than she'd been in England. We were dashing about like mad creatures. We enjoyed husband hunting too much to waste time searching for antiques.
And did you find a husband?
You know that I did not. I found men so handsome I could hardly speak. One, a Captain Hibbard, even asked my mother for my hand, but she did not think that I liked him, so she turned him down for me. It's still quite vexing.
You would have told him yes?
No, but I should like to have told him no myself.
Were there many proposals?
I mainly remember being grateful to the officers, the middle-aged gentlemen, who taught me to speak to a man. Small talk was always a challenge, and they were ever so patient with an awkward young girl. I knew the limits of flirtation, of course. All of the English girls did. But it was dizzying to be waltzed away through the ballroom and off into the gardens to be the object of a young man's fancy.
Did you like to waltz?
I love most dancing, but I've never really liked the waltz. Too much whirling about.
Should you like to try it again? Perhaps more sedately?
You are very charming, Max.
As are you, my dear.
It makes one glad to be alive.
Are we?
I am glad, anyhow. Glad to have lived. Glad to know the power of life.
Then yes, we are. But they await more from you. What happened when you returned from Egypt?
We lived a rather sedate life at Ashfield, and I settled in to entertain myself between visits to friends about the country. I would sit at the piano and play and sing until Mother banged for me to stop. I even wrote a bit of an operetta, a maudlin little piece called Marjorie, with a handsome tenor desperately in love with beautiful Marjorie.
Did she love him back?
In an operetta? What a peculiar idea. She wouldn't have him, and so he married a dull country girl and had settled into his dull country life. But Marjorie realized, as she lay dying, that she was in love with him after all. She sent for him, and he loved her so that he abandoned his life and his new wife to rush to her side.
Where she was healed by the angels, no doubt.
Oh, of course not. She used the last of her strength to reach for him in a final song before she died.
Maudlin, start to end, Much better that you became a purveyor of mysteries. Your life as a composer would have garnered you great scorn.
Without doubt. But girls all over England would have hummed my tunes and dreamt of unattainable heroes.
So many men are unattainable.
Yes. Sometimes even when they've been attained.
Yes. Tell them of your first husband.
I'd come to an understanding. It was never an official engagement. With the eldest brother of a friend of mine, his name was Reggie, and he was determined to wait to grow his career so as to better provide for me.
A very generous man.
I suppose I should have been grateful, but it did seem that he should have been at least a little jealous, a little concerned that I might meet someone else.
He seems quite trusting.
No, he should not have been, because in the midst of my engagement to Reggie, I met and fell in love with Archibald Christie.
Where did you meet?
At a dance in Chudley. The soldiers stationed in Exeter were there, and Archie was a friend of a friend of mine. He was tall and handsome and an excellent dancer.
Did he court you in Chudley?
No. He went out of his way to come to Torquay to see me. He rode a motorbike and was desperate to become a member of the Royal Flying Corps. He had ambition and would further his careers in the sky.
Did you know you loved him immediately?
Not immediately. I was simply taken with his strangeness. He was so unlike me as to invite constant intrigue. He had decided opinions about the future of aeroplanes and military advancement. His forceful logic was a powerful draw for my sentimental inclinations. Poor Reggie paled in comparison.
Poor Reggie.
Archie said he'd known he must marry me when we danced in Chudley.
Precognition, I suppose.
A passionate heart, Max. He spoke of marriage as an imperative. You've got to, he said to me. And I did.
So you were married?
Yes. On Christmas Eve day in 1914.
Just before the war.
Yes. 6 months before World War I and the end of England as we knew her. At the start of the war, Archie was sent to France to fight, and I returned to Mother and my grandmother at Ashfield. Like all of us who were able, I looked for how I could best serve.
You were a nurse?
Yes, at first. I volunteered with a voluntary aid detachment to attend to wounded soldiers. Oh, it was dreadfully hard. There was so much suffering and we knew so little. I kept my head about me, was promoted and began assisting in the dispensary along with an apothecary.
Learning a great deal about many of the poisons that appear in your later novels.
Why, yes. I suppose that's true. I did learn a great deal about poisons, about tinctures and powders. I also learned to write.
Is that when it began in earnest?
Not in earnest then, but I was reminded of Madge's taunts that I could not write a novel. On a walk one day, it came to me that I should write a detective story. There it was, a tiny wriggling idea that wouldn't be still. I pondered it as I made my way from the dispensary to Ashfield and back again. If I were to write a detective novel, someone should have to die, and they would have to die of something, else it wouldn't be a murder and there would be no need for a detective. As I was working with the apothecaries and the chemist, it seemed right that the victim should die by poison. It also was important to me that it be nothing overly unusual. There is something quite satisfying when something is obvious, but not absolutely obvious.
Meaning?
Well, the reader should know that it is absolutely possible to do a thing, but highly unlikely that it should be done at all. We must be able to consider the murderer obvious in hindsight only, and have no reason to consider them before they are revealed.
And how did you come to that frame of mind?
Through walking and muttering to myself. It was quite like taking my little hoop for a turn round the garden. Who should it be? How should they do it? What clues needed to be overt and what needed to be obscured? It came to me that our Belgian refugees were quite useful, and before long I had walked and talked and plotted myself into the company of Hercule Poirot, the meticulous inspector.
Brava!
Thank you, sir. I just wish I had not made him quite so old, nor Miss Marple either. Had they been younger, I might have had more fun continuing along with them.
How did the writing go? Did you write in one fell swoop, or did it take the whole of the war years?
Months, not years, but only that because I could write in the dispensary during the quiet times, and Mother insisted that I should go on holiday alone to finish it.
Did she really?
Yes, I was absent-minded to the point of worthlessness at home. Not nearly so bad at work, but only for fear that I should poison someone should I not pay attention. So I headed to Dartmoor and the Moreland Hotel for 2 weeks to complete the last half of the mysterious affair at Stiles.
Did you know it was worthy of publication immediately?
I only knew that it was completed. It was done as well as I could do it. Of course, I knew it could be better, but I had no idea how I could make it so. So off it went to the publisher for a swift rejection, and then to another, before I sent it away to John Lane at the Bodley Head. It was in the midst of all of this that Archie came home from France and we moved to London. We rented a flat and he worked at the Air Ministry. To pass the lonely days, I studied bookkeeping and shorthand. I was terribly slow compared to the young girls in attendance, but I got on well enough, and then the war was over. Perhaps it was not unexpected for some, but it certainly caught me by surprise. I was practicing shorthand in class 1 minute, and then we were out in the streets dancing.
It must have been thrilling.
Oh, all the reservation and the dignity that we'd fought so hard to maintain was gone. Grown women, English women, dancing and weeping. It was like being transported to France in an instant.
You had momentous news of your own that year.
Yes. 1918 was significant in many ways. I had looked for a baby after every visit with Archie all during the war, but was insensible when the signs were real. I thought I was merely ill.
And all the while, it was Rosalind.
Yes. Girls, they said, brought tummy sickness.
And boys?
Dizziness and fainting.
Much better that she was a girl, then.
Perhaps. But it is still hard to remember when vomiting into the gutter when visiting one's publisher.
Your daughter, Rosalind Margaret Clarissa Christie, was born on August 5th, 1919.
And Poirot was birthed in October 1920.
Fathered by John Lane.
In a manner of speaking, yes. Oh, I was so thrilled at the thought of selling a book of mine that I would have signed anything. I committed to publishing Stiles with them and to the next 2 books I should write.
Well done.
Oh, the contract was a blessing and a curse, but it had to be honoured. I wrote The Man in the Brown Suit, The Secret Adversary, and The Murder on the Links in those first years of marriage. By 1924, I was done with my contract with them, and I had moved to William Collins and Son.
You were doing remarkable things during that period. I'm particularly fond of the notion that you were one of the first Europeans to surf standing up.
To be young and sturdy. Oh, I have always enjoyed bathing so. Archie was offered a post with Major Belcher, who would take him round the world.
And you were to go with him?
And I did. We arranged Rosalind with my sister and set off.
Was it glorious?
Oh, it was filled with seasickness. And then it was glorious. Archie and I learned to surf on long boards in South Africa. You would lie upon your tummy and ride the waves in. We would spend our afternoons in the sea. In Honolulu, we learned to surf standing up. It was magnificent until you fell off, and then it was a bit like waltzing on the stairs. Once my bathing costume was torn away almost completely.
How did you manage?
I scuttled to the beach holding my scraps and bought a clever woolen bathing suit that would have scandalized my mother. It was a glorious year. When we returned to England, Archie scrambled for a job, and I kept writing to help as I could. We rented and then bought a house. I continued to write. Archie began to golf regularly. Rosalind was growing up.
It sounds idyllic.
It was, except that it was all on the edge of coming apart. My mother died, and Matt was away, and so I set myself to readying Ashfield for sale. The house had been poorly maintained, and there were rooms filled brimful with things to be done and packed and sold. It was dreadful to be so close to my mother's things, with no mother to give them meaning any longer. Archie didn't come up often to keep us company, and I felt as if I were drifting in a void. If I could erase any time in my life, it would be then.
An interesting story emerges from that void.
Oh, don't, Max. I would really rather not.
Agatha, in a world full of scandals, at the end of a life well and truly lived, do you believe sharing this will matter so much?
Oh, I cannot even begin to address that question.
The content of one's life?
I don't wish to discuss it.
Agatha?
Oh, some things are better left unspoken.
But the world wants to know. They feel as if they have a right to know.
They have no more right than I, and I don't remember anything about it.
Oh, come now, you must remember something. It was near to Christmas.
Oh, nothing of the sort. It was weeks before Christmas. It was early December.
Well, you remember that, at least.
It was all so dreadful, I couldn't take it in.
Yes, when Archie told you he was leaving you.
Archie told me he wanted a divorce, that he was well and truly in love, and though he was dreadfully sorry, he wanted to be free
could marry Nancy Neal.
Don't speak her name.
Is it still so painful?
Oh, the whole affair is dreadfully embarrassing, and I simply wish to put it all behind me for good.
But this seems to be the climactic moment of your marriage to Archie.
We were married for 12 years. 12 very happy years on the whole. Years filled with excitement and challenge. We travelled round the globe together. We had a child. We bought and kept homes together. I began my life's work during those years and learnt to be a mother and a wife. And it's all to be summed up in this absurd blankness here at the end.
It isn't a summary, Agatha, but it does feel like the terminal punctuation at the end of a sentence.
Oh, I don't know, Max.
You don't know?
No. You are asking me to remember what I cannot remember. How can I remember something I have no memory of in the first place?
There are others' memories, their recollections. Mrs. Agatha Christie found alive.
Oh, must we?
Or you would never ask less of one of your characters.
Oh, proceed.
You make me feel like an inquisitor.
You always loved digging deep into the past.
Indeed.
December 3rd, then, 1926.
Archie?
Yes, Archie. In the midst of my grief for my mother, in this wreck of a house that I had loved for so long, he told me there was nothing to be done, that he was quite sorry, but that he was in love and he must be with her. It was a familiar refrain. I've just got to. Only now it wasn't a proposal, it was a dismissal. Now it was another woman he had to have. and it would never be me again.
You didn't believe in divorce?
I didn't. I don't. I never have. But what one chooses to believe is sometimes out of step with what can happen in real life.
What happened when he told you?
We quarrelled.
Of course.
He was insistent. I was angry. He was angry. I was tearful. He threw his clothes into a suitcase and left to spend the weekend with her.
And then what?
Oh, there is so little point.
Try, Agatha.
I wanted to get away, to escape from everything, from the house, from my memories, from my life. I have always loved to drive, and so I took the car and drove.
What do you remember after that?
Oh, I don't remember. Oh, don't make me try. Tell them if you must, but I cannot.
She took the car. It was found in Guildford by a man out walking in the early morning hours. She had driven it over an embankment and walked away, leaving her coat and identification. They were very afraid she'd been drowned in the Silent Pond, a lake not far from the car. It was the same lake that had figured in a story of Agatha's where a young woman had drowned. They dragged the lake, but found no body. Dozens of witnesses were interviewed, and no one shared the same story. The world had decided the authoress of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd had committed suicide, or had been murdered by her husband. The most unkind speculation was that Agatha had staged it all as a publicity stunt to increase book sales. Poor Agatha. The countryside was searched. She was nowhere that anyone could find. 11 days after she vanished, the police and the press found her registered under the name Teresa Neal in the Hydropathic Hotel in Harrogate, which is in Yorkshire. She claimed to have no memory of how she came to be there. Archie came to collect her and take her to London. Miss Neal's name was printed in all the papers, so she took an extended holiday to escape the scrutiny. Archie Christie took Agatha to doctors and specialists who agreed that she had amnesia brought on by grief and exhaustion. Through it all, the public loved her. She and Archie were divorced in 1928. He married Nancy Neal shortly thereafter.
It was recommended to me that I should get away to recover. And I did so want to get away. So I booked myself a ticket on the Orient Express.
There you are, dearest.
Yes, here I am.
Very good. The worst of it is over.
Yes, and the best is yet to come, for it is in my travels that I found you, Max.
It feels quite rude to be grateful for your troubles, because they brought you to me. But I cannot help but be so.
I shall find it in my heart to forgive you.
Tell them of your travels, Dame Agatha.
It was not often that a woman would travel alone, but I wanted no companionship at that dark time. I had decided to travel to the West Indies until a naval officer named Commander Howe spoke to me of Persia. He and his wife recommended that I travel the Orient Express to Baghdad and see Mosul, Basra, and Ur. I was thrilled at the thought of Ur, for I had read about Leonard Woolley's finds at Ur in the Illustrated London News.
I have always loved the Orient Express. How was it travelling by train so long alone?
I was prepared to spend my days in solitude, watching the scenery, writing, and reading, to let the silence fill my days and to slowly heal. It is astonishing how unwilling people are to let you alone.
Still, you made your way.
I did. I toured the sights along the way, Stamboul, Damascus, Beirut, and I did eventually visit Ur.
And there you found me.
Indeed, I did. I made the time to see the dig at Ur and was introduced to you. Oh, how magical it was to see the ziggurat and the men digging through the sands, framed by the colours of the sunset. Oh, how foolish of me to have passed it by as a girl.
You would likely have not appreciated the visit as a girl, and your taste for the Middle East would have been turned for good.
Perhaps it would have.
It was your attention to the work that made me notice. So few people are attentive to the science of archaeology. They merely want to see the artifacts and hear of kings and queens. You were genuinely interested in the question of how people lived. Not pharaohs, but ordinary people. And not simply ancient people, but the workers digging in the pits and the drivers and the cooks.
I was, and I am. Our lives are made of moments. How can we understand them unless we pay attention to all of it?
That, my dearest, is what makes you such a memorable writer.
Not a memorable woman?
That, too. Do you know when I fell in love with you?
When did you fall in love with me?
Friends had sent me to escort you home to England.
Oh, there was really no need.
And it was on that trip that you captured my heart.
Was it during the visit to Najaf or Kabbala?
It was later, at the desert lake outside Uhadir. It was frightfully hot, and you said you'd like to bathe, but were embarrassed that you had no suit. When I asked if you might find a substitute of some kind or other, you made do with your chemise and a pair of knickers.
Well, you made do with shorts and a vest.
I did. But when we had finished our swim and we were ready to go on, we found that the car had sunk into the sand and would not be moved.
Oh, yes, it was dreadful.
You act as if it were rarely upsetting, but what I recall is your quietly climbing into the back of the car and falling asleep.
Well, there was nothing to be done.
No, there was not. Our guide had headed off to seek our rescue. We were there with precious little water. No one knew where we were. Other women would have panicked, but you were calm and relaxed enough to sleep. I knew you would not be a woman to fuss through the difficulties of life.
Thank you, Max. I wanted a companion who trusted me, and I found that trust in you. Besides, an archaeologist is the best husband a woman can have. The older she gets, the more interested he is in her.
Well, I certainly am.
Perhaps we both are. After 46 years of marriage, I hope we can still amuse each other.
As do I.
Well, my tea is cold with all of the talking. I do hope I've sated them enough that we can go back to the quiet contemplation of our lives. If you wish for more, you can always read one of my books. That is, after all, why I wrote them.
Well, you'd better be off. She'll wander about and tell tales to herself now. Weren't we lucky that she took the time to write them down for us?
Tea with Agatha premiered at NC State University Theater Fest in 2016. Sadly, Theater Fest for this summer has been canceled. However, University Theater has announced its season for next season, which starts in the fall, and it's a good one. So be sure to follow them on social media or visit their website, which will be in the episode notes for more information. Mia and Gus will join me on a virtual talkback to discuss the show and the literary and theatrical legacy of Agatha Christie on Sunday, April 19th at 7 p.m. on Facebook Live. Information on that will also be in the episode notes. On another note, the RDU on Stage podcast has been nominated for 3 Indie Week Best of the Triangle Awards, Best Local Website or Blog, Best Twitter Feed, and Best Podcast. You have until May 4th to vote for all of your favorite small businesses and organizations. And speaking as a small business owner myself, your support means everything to us right now. If you like what you've heard today, please follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, subscribe to the podcast, or follow us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, stay healthy, stay safe, and stay engaged, and support your local theater.